Hi, I'm Chris Hecker, and this is Chaim Gingold, and we are going to talk about advanced prototyping, and we have plenty of material, so we are going to jump right in. Okay, so here's our incredibly caricatured version of how you make a game. You have a game idea. Then you have some questions about that, like, how am I going to control the guy with the big boobs or whatever? And then you prototype to answer some of those questions. Then you take the results of the prototype, you develop your game, and then you put it in a box and sell it to people. This talk, yes, thank you so much. This talk is about prototyping part, obviously, and a little bit about how you ask questions, because that's actually vital to doing the, no more laser pointers except for the one, it's stuck on. It's really important how you ask the questions. There are questions that are prototypable and questions that are not. It is easy to confuse the two, and you will waste tons of your own time and your team's time if you don't ask them correctly.
One caveat. So we put advanced in the title of this talk. So we're actually assuming that people have some experience prototyping. So we're not going to talk about a lot of the basics, and we're going to try to touch upon like some subtle odd points that we think that are sort of counterintuitive.
Yeah, we actually had 140 slides, which is basically like a 3-hour epic, and then we like went through and like tore all the obvious stuff out. So this is only what we think is the delta from obvious to advanced. So if you're just completely lost, I'm sorry. All right. So why prototype? There are three reasons. These are the three official reasons why to prototype. Number one is the obvious one. You prototype to answer questions. Like you have a question. Will this control scheme work? Yes. No. You can test it. Whatever. We're going to talk about all that, how you judge that. The second one is just as important. During development of the prototype, you find upside, which is unexpected cool stuff, and downside, which is stuff you thought was going to work and didn't. Both of these are surprising. You find these while you're prototyping. And these usually bubble bottom up. As opposed to top down, answer questions are top down. I have, Chaim, can you answer this design question for me? Well, let me go see a prototype. And then the upside is like you come back and you're like, I can kind of answer that question, but check out this totally cool thing that happened when I accidentally set that color to red. And then the third thing is persuade and inspire. And that is also just as vitally important. You have an idea, and that's why you're prototyping, something you're prototyping, and you want to persuade people that it's the right solution, or persuade yourself that it's the wrong solution by testing it. And that's an incredibly important part. So all three of these are things that, if you're not doing all three of these, you're not prototyping very well.
Yeah. So a key point is that prototypes do not actually generate ideas. So like one mistake that sometimes happens is just like, oh, we have this problem we need to solve, let's prototype it. But if you don't actually have an idea of how you're going to solve it, it's kind of hard to actually test out the idea. So prototypes do not generate ideas. They're ways of testing ideas and additionally finding upside and downside and exciting people. So this is a traditional model of game development, say like back in the 80s, where you have like making a game is really cheap and simple. You sort of talk about it, you make something, and when you're halfway through, you sort of realize that it wasn't what you expected, and you go back and you change it some more, and you can do this because it's very cheap. You've only got like 4 people on your team, and you're not spending much money. However, when you go to sort of modern games, when you have like multi-million dollar budgets, like 100 people, you can't get halfway through the project and be like, oh man, like we're doing this wrong. We should try this other way because the term, like you're not agile. It's like really hard to steer this thing, and you sink. So the naive model of prototyping would be like you talk about something, you prototype your game, and then you go and you actually build the real thing. We found that the truth is actually a little bit more complicated. What ends up happening is that like you build something, you build one prototype, and then as you do that, it sort of uncovers a bunch of other questions you didn't realize were actually there to begin with. So as you're prototyping and developing ideas, you sort of find new prototypes you want to write, and then the point is you don't even know at the beginning what all the problems are. You don't even know all the problems you're going to have to solve until you're halfway through answering the ones you did know.
And this messiness of the slide is kind of a theme. Now the rest of the talk isn't explicit about the messiness. Like this slide, we kind of front loaded the messy message, but like you don't know what the hell you're doing. That is the whole point of why you're prototyping. And so in places later in the talk where we're like, well, we did this and then we did this and it looks clean, it actually involves something much more like this, where there was tons of feedback in the whole process. Things didn't work, ships were sinking all over the place, we were plugging holes with other smaller ships.
Yeah, and so the reason why we think that this loop happens is that on the one hand, sort of discussion and prototypes are very agile and cheap and fast. On the other hand, when you actually go to build the real thing, as you get more and more heavy, you begin to validate your ideas more because they become more real. So on the one hand, you're sort of validating things as you move to the right, and as you validate them, you find new problems. So you sort of problems bubble back down this way, and then you take those problems and you write prototypes and you send the solutions back that way. So the first section of our talk is metrics. So we sort of sat down and thought, how do you know a good prototype when you see one? How do you know if your prototype sucks or if it's awesome? Like, what are the characteristics that make a good one?
And we're trying to be analytical here. Like, let us figure out the set of things that you can judge a prototype by.
So one good quality that prototypes have is that they are cheap. They don't take very long to make. They are very, very agile. You can sort of maneuver them very easily. Like, very small teams are involved. Like, usually most prototypes are written by one person.
And if you're writing them with more than one person, it's kind of an alarm bell, and you're likely to go off the rails.
Another really key property of prototypes is they are falsifiable. Like, good prototypes make some kind of claim. Like, the control scheme should be, if I push up, the guy jumps, and if I push down, he crouches. And these prototypes would also be testable. Like, you should be able to, once you have the prototype written, be able to tell whether or not it actually works. You should have some way of falsifying it. And good prototypes are often tested, and you learn lots of stuff from them. If you're not doing any of these things, pay attention. So here's an example of a prototype I wrote for Spore, which is about the space game, and you can sort of fly around to a planet. There's a whole like set of automata, like terraforming simulation in here. You can abduct plants and animals. You can visit natives in different planets, and you can blow the crap out of them and exterminate them, and you can talk to people over a comm screen. And this is actually kind of like a surprising thing. This comm screen, we didn't realize that we wanted this interface, and then it sort of like happened partway through. This prototype took like, 6 months, something like that, to write. It was like the whole level of the game. And that was kind of like that didn't work so well, because 6 months is actually a very long time to be working on one prototype, because they're supposed to be fast.
It was not cheap.
It was not cheap. It was definitely not cheap. And the other thing that's interesting about it is that the sort of design was really big, and there were very few pieces of it that were actually sort of falsified. Like, sort of the terraforming game, we nailed that very focused question, and we're able to falsify that, and we could play that game. But other parts of it, there were sort of a lot of parts of the design we didn't get to sort of falsify and make claims about.
And even though, like, as Spore, I mean, those of you who saw the stuff last year, like, it's a giant game with lots of smaller sections. This was one of the smaller sections, but even then, it was way too big for a single prototype.
Yeah. So that was kind of like one of the seductive traps. It was like, oh, this is just one piece of the whole game. We can just write one prototype for it. So, and of course, there was even a scripting system where you could like write dialogue content for the conversation trees, and that was totally wrong, because it was like, let's do all this upfront like development work in like Lex and Yak, and then we'll like use it later. But I had no idea what the hell the dialogue system should even be.
Right. And we're going to talk way more about that on a concrete level in a minute. Keep going.
Okay, so another key property of prototypes is that they are relevant. That like what you learn in the prototype actually matters to the game you're making. So it's very easy sometimes to sort of get trapped in like these like sexy cool toys, and you're like, oh, this is totally awesome, and everyone's like, yeah, this is cool. But then then they don't actually matter to the actual game itself. So you got to make sure that you're sort of tethered to reality, and the problems and solutions you're after actually relate to the big project. So this is a demo of a prototype called Game Lab I wrote, which is an exploration of sort of agent-based behavior. And the question that I was asking here was, can we have a simple system which gives us lots of interesting agent behavior, such as like we can see creatures like playing games and like being happy, being sad, waiting in line. And it definitely was able to falsify it was a falsifiable prototype of, can we do cool agent behavior with simple rules? It did not ask the question, unfortunately, how do we integrate this with the actual game mechanics? So everyone was excited about this, and then we never really knew how to integrate it. And only like a year later, people were like, "Oh, we have something here. Can we use that?" So it didn't quite nail that relevance question, which is absolutely key.
So like we were saying earlier, the surprising feedback thing is part of, if your prototype is not doing this, it's failing as a prototype in some ways. Like, this is an important metric to judge all prototypes. It's not just like, oh, hopefully we'll solve the problem and maybe get some upside. It's like, you should be generating upside. If you're doing cool and interesting stuff, cool new stuff should come and bubble up. It should also be inspiring, and people should come to you and like it should make them want to like answer more, ask you more questions. It should make you them say, okay, I want to play with your thing, and then that gives me the idea of these other parts of the game. So they're constantly giving you feedback. You can't shut them up. You're like, get out of my office so that I can actually continue working on this prototype.
Yeah, I mean, good prototypes. They inspire you to solve more problems. They show you the new problems that need to be solved.
Right. And the persuasive point is totally just as important. This first point about fun is not just for gameplay prototypes. We're making video games. Every piece of technology, every piece of UI, every piece of audio that goes into the game should be fun and entertaining and interesting. They should be tangible. They should be like a chunky piece of thing I can grab. It's clear. This is what this prototype is solving. I can totally tell. And disruptive. So by disruptive, we mean you're changing people's minds by definition. Like people, there's like the status quo, and then you have a new idea for something you want to try, and you like make a prototype, and that like shifts the status quo. You're like, that changes the universe.
Right. If you've changed a lot of people's minds when they see your prototype, it's probably a good one.
So here's an example from some of our development. This is our procedural animation tool for creatures, and it's got, you know, it's kind of Maya-like, but for arbitrary wacky creatures. And it's got like here's a punch animation with some effects. And so we were working on this, and during the same time, like there was no other creature animation in the entire game because hey, we were still working on the tool. And this is a prototype itself, which actually metastasized into a real tool. There was another prototype going on that didn't actually have animation for the creature game. And what happened was there was a lack of viscerality there, and they were taking some directions that some of the people working on the animation tool were like, oh, I think we could go do that differently. So we took exactly one day and turned the animation tool, commented out a ton of code, and turned it into a prototype that's at a more visceral level interacting with the world. So you can see you can interact with trees and stuff like that. This is just the procedural animation authoring tool hacked up to allow these creatures to punch each other. And then we were like, oh, well, that only took a day, and like, you know, computer hardware is pretty fast, so hey, we'll put them on a height field, and like, okay, so that's cool. Oh wow, now we can see like how they actually like scale and what ground speed looks like, which didn't look right before. But like, how big is this on a planet? Like, this is not, you know, you can't really tell what's going on here. It's just a flat thing. Does the planet size matter? Oh well, how can we ask that problem? How do we answer that question without actually writing the planet simulator? Because this other guy was writing the planet prototypes and all of that stuff. So what we did was we just drew how big the planet was, and you can just see the thing. We're like, oh, boom, this answered all questions. Like, there were all this discussion of like, oh, the curvature matters, oh, the curvature doesn't matter, oh, you can run too fast, oh, you can't, because how long will it take you to get around the world? We're like, boom, put some wireframe planet in there, look, this is exactly how big it is relative to the rest of our
time. Yeah, I mean, the key takeaway here is that you can't, it's hard to falsify a conversation, but you can like spend hours debating these things forever, and it's like, you see that, and it's like, game over, everyone's convinced.
Right. So this is an amazing, magical thing that happens when you get something that's really cheap and really persuasive, sometimes called propaganda. Let's say you work at this company, and this is you down here in the corner. If you can do a prototype, you can move up in the world. And this actually happened. So with the prototype I just showed you, there's like lower level people. There's an overarching design, and some people down below say, "Hey, I've got this really cool idea." Boom, end run around the entire situation. Like, you can't argue with a prototype. Like, you can sit down and you can play it, and it's like cool or it's not. And if it's cool, like, everyone just shuts up.
So one of the things we can do is we can also think about design documents as if they were prototypes, right? So a design doc, in some sense, is a sort of a cheap definition or exploration of what the design should be. And so let's compare the two of them and see which one tastes better. So documents are really, really cheap to write. Like, we can talk, we can document very, very inexpensively. Prototypes are also cheap, but not as cheap. However, prototypes have this nice advantage of being interactive. So this is an interactive medium, and a document cannot actually let us touch and feel and see what the thing we're making is going to be, whereas a prototype actually can. And documents are actually really boring. It's actually really hard to get people to read design documents unless they have lots of pictures in them. But prototypes, people like want to play them. People can see them in action. They understand what the design is. And finally,
it's like if you let's say you have an idea for a game or a part of your game, and you convince some people on your team by talking to them or maybe by writing a design document or a wiki page, you should be slightly nervous because you actually don't know whether you're right either. But you've convinced all these people via rhetoric, and now all these people start charging in a direction, and you don't actually know whether you are right or not. Whereas if you have a prototype, you're golden. You have proved that this thing works. There's a scientific aspect to it.
Yeah.
And all good science
has good questions. So we claim that behind every good prototype is a very, very good question. So the best prototypes have always come from the best, most focused questions that sort of knew what it was that they were getting at. So, for example, in this prototype that we're about to show you of the creature editor, the question at hand was, can we make legs, sort of these intelligent objects that know about things like staying on the floor and staying attached to the creature's hip? And can this UI concept be easy to use, aesthetically very expressive and powerful, and also like really like fun and even fun to touch?
Hot.
And hot. And
how's real?
Oh, right. So this was maybe the fifth iteration or something of this particular experiment. So this, the question sort of set up the boundaries of this exploration, and then like three or four iterations into it, I ended up with this design, and then I could like take people, like sat them down in front of it, and we're like, all right, make something, like what do you think? And people were like, they got it, like, and sort of the 3D UI aspect of it just kind of like worked. So,
and we'll show this in context of a lot, in the context of the overall design problems sitting within.
So this is an example of like a very focused question. It's like, is this UI concept going to be easy to use, hot, powerful? So,
we'll do this first. Yes.
Yes.
Oops.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. So let's talk about some more questions. So. Can we make a fun social game between characters? Sounds like a plausible question. The problem with this question is it doesn't actually make a specific claim that we can falsify. It's almost as if it's counting on the possibilities of the prototype inventing the solution for you.
And prototypes do not generate ideas. They generate upside, which is slightly different.
So we reject this question. Bad question. Is leg UI concept user-friendly, powerful, and hot? And that's sort of like a very focused question. It has an idea behind it. And we tried it out. We could put people in front of it. So excellent question.
It was testable.
Can rolling around with a sticky ball be compelling? So as some of you probably know, like when Katamari Damacy was originally pitched to Namco, people were not convinced. Like they were like, what? Rolling around? What? That doesn't sound fun. But then as soon as the people had the prototype in their hand and they could play it, they got it. And it was like the specific question here lets you validate it and see where that's going to work.
So even things that are subjective, like compelling, can make good questions because you can test that. Like 8 out of 10 people found it compelling, even though no one can really define exactly what compelling is. But it's still something you can sit people down in front of and talk and test.
So here's a design doc for a game. This is going to be fun. So this is interesting because it is making a claim. It's like the claim is the game that results from this document going to be good? The problem with this question is that it's too broad, right? It's like, the whole point of prototyping is that you can sort of move very quickly and make quick progress on very focused questions. So the scope of this is too large. So this is basically the space prototype. It's like that game was sort of too big to attack with one prototype.
So you've got this kind of set of questions. You know what you want to do now. And so how do you actually do that? What we say the first step is don't actually write a prototype, because the whole process that brings you to writing prototypes from actual large-scale production software is this process of saying, oh, I can do this cheaper. And so you can apply that same meta process to prototypes, and the cheapest prototype is the one you didn't write. And so you can steal it.
Right. So one time we were having a design discussion about like a UI where you could like roll over icons, they would sort of grow and shrink. We're trying to figure out how to fit a lot of content onto one screen. We're like, oh, what if the things grew and shrank as you moused over them? And I was talking to Will, I was in his office, and I was like, all right, like, oh, you know, I'll come back in a week, I'll like have something we can play with. So then like I walked down the hallway and I was like, wait a minute, I know how to do this right away. So I just like walked over to my friend Carol's desk and I was like, can I borrow your laptop for a second? So she was like, sure. So I like picked it up and like went into Will's office and I was like, here, let's click. And then we were playing with it and we were like, oh yeah, this is actually not what we want. So that was like the cheapest prototype. It was like, we just like stole it.
So another way to do it is fake it. We have a magic art director, Ocean Quigley, and we have the building editor, which is part of our game that you construct buildings out of, used to be done with, why is it not playing? Oh, man. Okay, hold on a second. Yeah. Let us.
hardware accelerated video is ass.
Okay.
Just forget it. Yeah.
Okay. Like, why won't it play on both monitors? Who knows? Okay, so we have this building editor that's like, and originally it was like this scaffolding based thing. You build the structure of the building. And Ocean was like, okay, this is insane. What we really want to do is stack together these things that you can actually deform the individual pieces, kind of a constructive, like, blocks kind of thing. And so what he did is in Maya, he went in and he's like, oh, hey, I've got bones and I've got morph channels. And so what I'll do is I'll hook up a bunch of Maya sliders to the various deforms on the, the morph channels and expose that through a quote UI, which basically means you select it in Maya and drag it with the translate thing and shoot a video of it, and it's just immediately clear how hot this is. You're like, I still want to stack those things together, and like it just boom instantly just wins the argument. Like there was just no argument anymore. It was like obvious.
The question of this prototype was, can if we have building blocks, how aesthetically compelling and interesting can those individual building blocks be? And the key thing is that here is that he was faking it, right? It's like he didn't need an engineer to actually go in and like write the code to like write some crazy deformation system. He just leveraged what Maya gave him and then baked off this video, which like faked all the underlying.
Right. Everybody knows how to do morph channels and everybody knows how to do boned meshes. It's like that's not the hard problem. The hard problem is what you do with it. It is not interactive, but it was, and that's it's definitely a fake it thing. But well, it is actually you're wrong. Because you could actually go sit down at his desk at Maya and like go over here and see this arrow. You can actually like grab this arrow and hold Alt, down with or hold the translate manipulator on, and boom, and the thing deforms. So it's interactive. He didn't write any code for it. He just hooked up a bunch of crap in Maya, which is like, I mean, hey, it took him like 3 hours. Whereas programming that up would have taken forever. Okay. Here's another thing you can do is rehash it. We're still in the don't write your prototype stage. This prototype is a metaball skin prototype we did for figuring out how to do the skin on the creatures. And when I did this prototype, it was metaballs. And so, hey, I've got this skin going on. And then I was like, oh, well, I'm wondering, we've got these creatures, and how can we pose them? Maybe I'll do a constraint-based simulator. And I've got this prototype sitting around. I'll just hack it into that. And then... well, we got to do some texturing stuff, so I guess I'll just hack that into that too, and then maybe I'll hack the procedural paint mode into that as well. And so, like this prototype, you can see this gluey UI here on the side. Like this prototype has like 8 miles of UI you can drag down and like set different modes, and it's like it's got the paint program, it's got the procedural paint, it's got like a modeling program, and it's totally ludicrous. But each one of those was a very small delta for something I already had. And once you've got this live UI hooked up, which we'll talk about later, it just makes it easy to switch modes. It's like I didn't need to start at like a blank CPP file and go like, how do I get my prototype going? So another really important axis here is the permission versus forgiveness axis. As the saying goes, it's always easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. We have quantified when it is easier to ask for permission versus forgiveness for you. Thanks to our art director, Ocean, the official number is 2 days. If it takes less than 2 days, just do it. Don't ask for permission. Hopefully you'll come out with something cool. If you come out with something cool at the other end of 2 days and you didn't do any of the other stuff you were supposed to do for that week for the 2 days, no one will even remember because you showed them this totally cool thing. If it takes you 3 weeks, then people will be like, I have no idea what you're doing. You're going totally off the rails. That's going to come back around at another point later. But the key thing is, if you can do something really quick that's incredibly punchy, just do it.
And finally, usually when we start out with our ideas, and I don't think that we're any less smart than you guys, we're usually wrong. So you pretty much want to find out as quickly as possible that where you're wrong and where your assumptions are incorrect. So you want to fail early, you want to fail often. So like as soon as you can get to that testing demo phase, you want to be there as quickly as possible so you can like bail on whatever isn't working and like move in the right direction.
So you got this like, you're going to sit there, you're going to start to write a program and you've got like a set of things you could do first. I could build the infrastructure for the blah, 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 or I could blah, 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 or whatever. There's like, 10 things. And like, there's some order dependence, but really you get to choose what you want to work on first. Work on the things that are most likely to fail first because you want to just know that instantly.
And finally, gathering reference materials is really key. If you guys saw Kyle and Kyle's talk yesterday, like you know that what they do is they often start with like music or images that appeal to them. They like draw concept art and they sort of use these inspirational materials sort of set the mood and tone and direction of where they're going. So that's a really cool way to start. So once you've got your once you've decided to write your prototype, so the next problem you should ask yourself is how do you decompose like a big sticky problem into like lots of little problems? Like Spore, for example, is like a huge huge interconnected mass of problems, and we can never, like, you can't prototype the whole thing. In fact, you can't even prototype, like, one level of it. You have to, like, really decompose it into, like, small pieces and do it in a way that makes sense. So what you would like to do, ideally, is, like, take your big problem, break it down into little problems, and then solve each of those little problems, and then reintegrate the solutions back together again, and everyone can go home.
That'd be awesome.
And then you just... The problem, though, is that once you have all those little solution pieces, they're not guaranteed to fit together again. And the reason for that is because if you slice the problem wrong, the solutions won't fit together either. So the reason for that is that design problems are these sort of like networks of constraints and like nasty problems that you don't even know about. And when you cut it up into pieces, you have to make sure that those pieces sort of fall along the lines that make the most sense, that sort of capture the most interconnections between your problems. So the question that you ask here when you decompose is, like, what's the most relevant to this question? Like, what's in and what's out? And you want to maximize the number of things that are out so you can make quick progress. However, when you're maximizing what's out, you want to make sure you keep track of what's connected. So the cool example of keeping track of what's connected is this creature demo we showed you earlier, where they didn't have to put the whole planet in there. They could just keep track of the connection of what's the scale relationship of this game to the whole planet was just like this giant wireframe sphere.
Which took about 15 minutes. And most of that was compiling.
So the key here is that you have these like two modules, right, and it has some connection between them, and like you pick the one you're going to do, and then in order to keep track of this design constraint connection, you sort of implement as little as possible of the other one, and you just like abstract it out. So here's a screenshot of the creature editor from Spore, and here is our current understanding of what the design decomposition is, and like we arrived at this like two years later or something, right? Or so
more.
Maybe more, I don't know. So, yeah, probably more. So, if someone had, like, given us this diagram, like, 2 or 3 years ago, like, it would have been so much faster. So we, like, had to figure this thing out as we went along, so.
Yeah, so the presentation here is going to be like, oh, look at these cool prototypes we made to fill in these boxes. But it wasn't really like that. And we'll talk about little bits of that. But, like, it was just this giant mass of, like, we try this. Okay, that didn't work. Okay, someone come up with an idea, because the prototype's not going to generate an idea. It just might give you, like, an inkling of what might work.
Yeah, like, maybe there's a new box here. We don't even know. Let's try it out, right? So we definitely had to discover this. And of course, this is like much more complicated than it even looks here, and there's connections everywhere else. So okay, the thing you saw earlier was sort of an exploration of just parts, right? Like, what is the aesthetic variety you get out of parts? So it sort of ignored everything outside of there. It didn't deal with how these parts are going to compose with one another, how you're going to create them, how you're going to destroy them, how it relates to the economy of the creature editor. So it just this prototype just focuses on that one section. This next one was about object composition, right? How do these pieces fit together? And with this prototype, it was sort of a 2D exploration of how do we get, can we snap pieces together to form creatures, right? And what's the manipulation going to look like? And it sort of captures the idea of legs a little bit, the idea of having a root node, a torso that you build off of, and there's a palette node, like you can drag stuff off of the palette on the left side of the screen, but there's no pages to it, there's no organization of the content, so it sort of abstracts that out.
And this one ran into some relevance questions, like Haim did this prototype and it was cool, okay, clearly this is like, this Lego thing has like a good visceral tactility to it, but people were like, well, rotating things in 2D is trivial, and rotating them in 3D is very difficult, and Haim's like, no, it'll work out great, and people are like, no, it's going to be really hard.
So the problem though is that like I basically like this was sort of like a bad cutting of the problem, right? It was like, oh, this like 3D stuff isn't that relevant because we can figure that out. So we sort of like missed that key connection. And then we ended up prototyping that in 3D next and sort of like, you know, took a long time to convince people that we should do it. And then we actually ended up doing it, and it didn't really quite work that well, so we had to revisit it later. So that's sort of like how you know if you like, cut something wrong. And then here's another prototype that sort of came out of the question here was, can we make a toy that's like that represents the creature's body that lets you sort of manipulate it as one unit? And it ignores the question of how parts go on. It sort of is just like assumed, like we accounted for the fact that you could later put things on. So one way you can keep track of a connection is by just verbally explaining, like it's just, I don't think that it's that relevant. This is how it's going to fit together. And we did that in 3D. And then there was another prototype that was done sort of to tie this other stuff together, which is like how does the editor tie into the creature game? So it's like you have these parts that you're going to be that cost money, like horns and mouths and things like that, and they're going to give you stats for your creature, and they're also going to be things you're going to edit aesthetically with in 3D. So So this really was about tying together the creature game, object composition, the parts, and the palette in sort of a very abstract way. But the heart of it was, what's like the tuning for this economy? How's it going to work? And the creature game is in here, right? Like click done. All right, I'm playing the creature game. Okay, now I'm back. And it just gave you money. So like the important thing with the creature game was I get money and I get stash back. And there was actually we ran into a problem here as well, which is that because this thing sort of abstracted out the parts, like the part content, like what do the mouths and the horns and everything look like? Like several months later down the line, people were like, wait a minute, like I don't quite feel comfortable with this like tech tree that this thing spec'd out.
Right, this thing
with the aesthetic.
This thing on the side here is like the palette, and you explored out through like a tech tree. And the problem was there's this aesthetic versus functionality question there. Like I want to be able to make any creature I want to make, and so if the dragon limbs are like off limits because I haven't just explored them yet, I can't make the creature I want. So there's a trade-off between functionality and aesthetic.
So the function, so the sort of that dimension of functionality versus aesthetics was like one of those hard couple design problems here that this slicing didn't capture.
So right, so it seemed like the fog of war, like expand the tech tree would work great. Oh, except for like you can't make the creature you want to make.
So really we needed a deeper connection between this and sort of this, how people felt about their creature. So that was missing. And finally, the leg thing that we showed you earlier, that prototype sort of has a notion of a torso in there, but it's a simplified version of what we actually ended up using, which was like this fully like physical kinematic thing. And so you could like put legs on top of this guy, move them around, and you could, so it's captured the relationship with the torso, but it abstracted out the rest of the torso.
And this one is in direct response to the 3D manipulation problem. So basically, we had the stigma sort of thing that Haim was talking about, that we showed the demos of earlier, or that was on the previous slides. And it turned out the 3D rotation problem is actually real, and it was a pain in the butt. And we tried a bunch of different things, and we kind of integrated the best guess we had, and it still was just a big pain. And so Haim was like, screw it, we're not going to do 3D manipulation, we're going to have a smart leg system that makes the manipulation, you know, implicit in the way you manipulate it. And so this is like, this box didn't exist. We thought this box, this is not a laser pointer. We thought this box was this box. Like, hey, there'll be some legs in there, you'll manipulate them, rotate them around, stick them together. But no, there's another box over here we discovered.
Yeah, so really the 3D problem led us to discover that there was this new unit we had to decompose separately. And the torso as well, at a certain point in time, we actually thought the torso was actually a part, like it wasn't actually an object either. So at a certain point, that was a question we asked, like, what if we think of that as just one object? So, but the point here is that sort of like it's really all about how you cut things up, and as you sort of explore and figure out where your design space is, you have to cut things up just to learn how you cut things up.
It's totally iterative. So, another way of thinking about this whole thing is that you've got these constraints. They're like, okay, I can't spend that much time on this thing, or I can't, you know, there's a whole bunch of things like this technology's not ready, so I'm going to like constrain away some of these problems. Within that box, like you've built this box that you're actually going to try and answer the question in, within that box you have freedoms. You can move around in that box. Like, oh, I can like, you know, I can make a 3D manipulator, or okay, I can like you make the space bar do this thing or whatever. Like, you've got these things you can play with. And then you've got the assumptions, like, guess what? If you walk through that door, the rest of the world's out there. We're not going to even do that. The planet is this wireframe thing. You can't keep walking in that direction. I'm sorry, that's not part of the prototype.
Right. Yeah. For example, like in the leg thing, we assumed that you could like drag the legs out of the palette and put them on. You could snap feet onto and off the end of them, and just sort of like verbally said that. Like, these are our assumptions.
And some people can call you on your assumptions. So like Haim had made the assumption about 2D rotation, 3D rotation, no problem. And people were like, wait, we had, you know, there's some experience there. So sometimes your assumptions like wash up against the like the reality of other people's opinions about what will be and will not be difficult. But it's kind of like the constraint thing is not bad. They're actually good. In that way that we all talk about, you know, constraints being freeing, it makes you choose what's really important, and you get a level of focus that allows you to get cool stuff happening on a day scale, as opposed to like, you know, the week and month scale, which you want to avoid. So it's like packing on, you know, go. You don't take your entire house and you pack to go on vacation. Like, you have to actually, it forces you to decide, like, I need underwear and I need suntan lotion and whatever.
It's really cool, like, when you have programmers and designers working together with these constraints, because programmers are like, all right, you get three things. Like, I can only do three. In fact, what do you want me to do right now? And designer's like, all right, what's the most important thing? So it really sort of forces you to sort of focus your design.
Right.
And figure out what's really key.
And we're talking more about that in a little bit, the collaboration angle. So what happens is this focusing of what you need to do makes you, you get into the economic question, which is, economics is all about, like, you know, what do you do in the face of finite resources? And so where do you spend your resources? Your resources are finite in a bunch of different ways. There's performance of the machine, there's, you know, your amount of time you're going to spend on it, there's how many, like, artists you can, like, you know, wrangle into, like, doing cool stuff for you over their lunch hour. There's a whole bunch of constraints. And so what are we spending our resources on? And the answer is, we're spending them on what we call characteristics of your prototype. So there's some listed here on the side. This is probably not all of them. You might have a different list. But things like interactivity, or how long does the prototype last, or how pretty is it, or how agile is the code base, and how robust is it, and that kind of thing. And you basically say, okay, I need to dial each one of these to a certain level in order to answer my question in a successful way. Now, life gets a little more interesting because these are actually coupled. And they're all coupled in sometimes intuitive and sometimes non-intuitive ways. So an obvious one is beauty and performance are obviously coupled. If I want to, like, add 100 times as many polygons into my thing to make it prettier, like, it's going to slow down. So there's a trade-off there. Clearly, performance and interactivity are linked because, like, my frame rate, the response time of my UI and the game, it depends on my frame rate, how much I can do. Usability and fun, like, it's very difficult to make something fun if it doesn't have a hot UI. It's not really usable if you don't have, like, the right click pressure and all of the
If it's hard to control, it's probably not. Super Mario Brothers would not be fun without, like, that nice control.
The tight control. A kind of non-intuitive one is, like, if your code is really agile, which we'll talk about in a little bit, it's hard to make it robust. Like, you know, really robust code gives up agility in order to get robustness in the face of bad data and things like that. So it's kind of like you're rolling out a character. You've got what kind of person do you want to be? Am I a thief? Am I a tank or whatever? I've got, like, you know, a certain amount of points. I'm going to spend them against my against spells and whatnot to learn. And you have to decide where you're going to do that. So on every one of these characteristics, you have this cost versus quality curve. And unfortunately, it's super nonlinear, which means that you start out at suck. So you're down here and you've got nothing, right? You're totally sucking, and sucking is free. For you only today, totally free. And then you can actually spend a little bit and get to okay. So from suck to okay is actually pretty cheap because you're on the right side of the curve. Like, you got a pretty good derivative there. Getting from okay to good starts to cost real time. You can see you're starting to, like, flatten out. You're getting towards the knee of the curve. Things are getting more painful. If you want to get to cool from good, you're in real trouble because, like, an increment in the quality bar costs a lot. And awesome is just way the hell down there somewhere. And you usually can't get to awesome in a prototype. And if you're going to try and get to awesome in a prototype, you would better be really clear that you need to do that because you're spending all of your resources on that.
I mean, awesome is for the shipping game, right? It's like, all right, we're going to throw, like, our team of artists and everyone at this and make this as cool as possible.
Right. And so here are some examples of that. In Spasm, which is our procedural animation tool, this is how the physics and our IK system sees the creature. It's a bunch of blocks. They're constrained together. You can do all the animations you need to do on this. In fact, you can't actually, there's nothing else you can do animations on except for, like, smiles and morph targets and stuff like that. So you've got this. All animations are done in this world. However, I was demoing this stuff, which I thought was pretty fucking cool, and, like, you know, all these animations, the animators are totally into it, and, like, it's got a cool aesthetic to it by itself. It's just got a funky, like, wacky, cartoony aesthetic. And then I was realizing it wasn't, like, coming totally home to people. And so I spent 3 days and put the mesh on it. Like, it doesn't take that long. Like, hardware rendering, right? You know, load up the mesh and I shove it on there and, like, I weight it to the bones and off it goes. And all of a sudden one of the producers comes up. He's like, I never really thought this animation system was going to work until you showed me this today. And I'm like, this has nothing to do with the animation system. Like, it's total, like, eye candy. But it's vitally important. Like, it actually took, it was so worth the few days because, boom, I just totally sold that person. Like, that person was totally in my camp all of a sudden. The example we showed you before of, like, giant plane of, like, numerical perfection versus height field of beauty and grunginess, like, it makes a huge difference. If it took one day for someone who had never written a line of OpenGL code before to just shove that in there, like, it's just like, I was like, we needed to do it, and I was like, oh, this would be a great way for this guy to, like, learn some more graphics programming, because it's just so easy to get a height field going. He got it going and boom, instant, like, mega viscerality. We didn't write a height field simulator for this. We didn't generate the height field dynamically. We had Ocean make it for us in, like, 3 minutes in Maya because we weren't solving that problem. We had abstracted that away with the sphere thing that we showed you earlier. And so really briefly, getting back here, there's some rules of thumb about what you do. So the real question is, where do you take your characteristics on this curve? How do you know when to do that? And so one rule of thumb is take everything that even remotely touches your prototype to okay. It's so cheap, and it makes such a, like, intangible, like, a non-intuitive difference to people. Like, just the human psyche is like, oh, there's a mesh on it. Of course, it looks like a creature. Of course it works.
Yeah, and the other thing is that sort of, you know, from the question of your prototype, which characteristics are important. If it's a gameplay prototype, you know you want fun and interactivity. And those things sort of branch out into things like usability and aesthetics. So if you sort of start by thinking about what are the characteristics that are key, then looking at those linkages, it'll let you know what things you need to invest more in.
And so, and I don't mean, actually, it's important, this is a recurring thing. Like, the fact that the guy needed to see this is not a flaw in him. It's just human nature. Like, you just, like, when you're doing this kind of thing, you're, like, making gut, visceral judgments about things, and all of those little bits matter. So getting to okay is totally worth it. Sometimes you have to get to a minimum quality bar, and that, of course, implies a minimum cost bar, and you need to be very careful and make sure you really need a minimum quality bar in those things, because if you have too many minimum cost bars, it means you're not light. It means you're not cheap. So one of the main ways you trade off quality and cost is by trading off on the code versus content axis. And we have another fancy graph here. So you've got cost on the vertical axis and quantity of stuff kind of it's generating or you get out of it on the horizontal axis. So, for example, if you're going to do a first-person shooter, the first level costs 90% of the entire thing. Because once you've got to write a 3D engine, you've got to write your sounds, your physics simulator, all of this stuff. Once you've got the first level done, like, boom, squeeze that level as fast as you want. Like, it's not a problem. Especially if there's, like, some dynamic procedural generation stuff in the mix. Like, if I have to write a height, let's say I'm writing a really nice-looking height field generator, right, noise and, like, blah, blah, blah. Getting the first height field that looks good is really painful. After that, how many height fields do you want? You want a billion? Fine. Like, content scales in a totally different way. Content, the initial thing costs a little bit more. You got to make your design bible, and you got to figure out like what your character designs are and stuff like that. But you know, the 15th oil painting you make costs just the same amount as the 32nd oil painting, modulo a little bit of training. So you got a slight down curve, but like you're basically totally linear there. And the reason this is interesting for prototypes is that prototypes live totally within this area, where the graphs cross, and so it's unclear.
Right, so this is like you have to make these hard judgments about do I want to do this with code or with content. If it's like an actually shipping game, like if you're way down on the right side of the curve, it's like a totally easy decision. But if you're right in the beginning of it, you have to figure out like what exactly is the shape of the curves for my specific application and where do they cross.
So let's contrast code and content a little bit, because this is one of the fundamental razors you use to trade off quality on your characteristics. So an obvious, slightly obvious thing is code is interactive and content is just dead bits. If you've got a bitmap displayed on the screen, there's no knowledge there. So whereas code, you can respond to the user. It can, it can generate new things. It can be parameterizable.
Code represents your sort of your understanding of the problem, right? It's like this is the mechanics of the interface of the simulation.
On the other hand, code, we should do it. But content is incredibly emotional, where code is totally autistic. Content, it's so easy to take a screenshot, you know, a picture of a baby and get like an immediate, like, boom, oh, wow, yeah, I'm viscerally, you know, I've got a visceral reaction. With code, you can at best get a kind of design look. Like a lot of, like, Heim's prototypes has this really clean, nice design look. Anti-aliased lines are turned on and things like that. But you don't get that visceral, emotional impact. And that's really key. So sometimes you need that, and that really weights heavily towards content.
So, for example, in the space prototype, like, we didn't really know what the conversation interface was going to be, and then it's like, assuming that it was like, well, what if we put, like, pictures of characters up there, right? Like, what if we get pictures of creatures looking scared and angry and sad, and just throw that up there? And people reacted very strongly to that. As soon as they saw it, they were like, oh, yes, we have to do that. That's totally it. And this is an example where you have to combine code and content together, right? I can't imagine this working if it was sort of like abstracted away. Like it just wouldn't have been punchy. Like no one would have bought the idea. And if you think about a game like Eco, for instance, if you were going to prototype the characters holding hands, you couldn't do that with code only, with just interaction like blocks, and you couldn't do it with just pictures of them moving around because it's all about the interaction of the dynamic. Like come hold my hand, and I'm going to move you around.
And so the like strengths and weaknesses of code versus content, the emotional strength of code and or of content, and the kind of the interactive procedural strength of code lead to this kind of conclusion, which is that like if you've written code to do something to solve a problem, you understand that problem. Right? If you've got a solution running and it's got code that's running it and actually solving the problem, you've got understanding. You've paid a lot for it because code is expensive, but you actually understand it. Whereas if you have content, you've got to say, let's say you want to have a guy walking through a jungle. If you have an AVI of a guy walking through a jungle rendered in Maya, like you're still clueless. You have no idea how to make that work. If you've actually got it working as an executable with code, you have understanding.
Right. If you've written a height field generator, you understand how you're going to generate the height fields for your game. As soon as we've written that leg prototype, we understood how we were going to make that leg thing work. If it had only been a Maya mockup of a leg, someone implementing a leg, like we would have no idea how to actually implement that. So code really equals understanding of the problem.
And so the cost, I mean, so why not just do everything in code? It's that cost graph before. Like, the cost of code is so steep, especially in the beginning. So you have to be very careful. You spend code where you need understanding, and you throw content in everything else. The default is content. Like, boom, I'm going to make an AVI out of this in Maya. Why won't that work? Okay, pull that into code. Okay, pull that other thing into code. Oh, man, it really sucks if I have to pull that one into code. Let's try and, like, you know, dodge around that with some assumptions and some constraints. So now you actually want to write some code, presumably. And so we're going to briefly go through some points about this. There's not actually that much code in here, don't worry. What's the most important thing about the code you write for prototyping? It has to be agile and fast. What does this mean? Agile means it turns really quickly. Like, you don't know what the hell you're doing. So if your code is very slow to turn, you've got this giant bloated ship moving in this direction, and you realize that this is not the direction you want to be moving in, you want to just be able to, like, boom, and go this way. That's agility. Velocity is when you know where you're going, or direction at least you're going, you had better be able to, like, produce results along that axis really fast.
So the things that aren't important are things like robustness and elegance and optimal code. Like, programmers are, like, in love with, you know, sort of like doing things the correct software engineering way. And, like, that stuff doesn't matter. That's like, when we talked about cutting the problem, that's outside of the scope of the problem. So one of the things you have to be able to do is sort of, like, reflect upon your sort of software engineering practices and think about which ones actually apply to this problem.
Right. They have to all run up against agility and velocity. Is this costing me agility and velocity? Yes. Boom, it's out. Now, there's a slight mitigating factor when you start to build, after you've done some prototypes, you start to build your own prototyping library. And we're going to talk a little bit about the structure of those libraries in a second here. But so you have, you know, as you lift something out of a prototype and bring it into a library, you want a little bit more robustness so it's not just crashing on you all the time every time you try and use it. However, the old adage of, like, you have to use before you reuse is vitally important here. Like, you have to make sure it actually is agile before you, like, suck it up into a library, because if you're reusing non-agile code, you're actually screwing yourself.
Right. You don't want to be spending time sort of prepping your prototype. It's like you want to be producing results and figuring out that you're on the wrong track as soon as possible.
So computers these days are fast and huge, especially for prototype size problems. If you have something where you're like, I need to allocate a flat gigabyte of memory. Well, you drive to Fry's and pay $30 and you come back and you allocate a flat gig of memory. Like, you can't do that on your shipping product, but for a prototype, it's totally appropriate. It's like, okay, I'll use a quad AMD 64 on this problem. Like, I just am trying to gain knowledge. Like, it's fine to buy, I mean, a quad AMD 64 costs, like, what, $600? Just buy one. It's like, don't spend the time, don't spend the 5 days trying to write the better algorithm. Just get the faster computer if that will actually get you to understanding faster, because you're probably wrong. And then, like, you've wasted a little bit of money, but you haven't wasted a lot of time. Time is so much more valuable.
It's interesting, actually, because in some sense, this is a way of abstracting things, right? It's like you're sort of kicking things out of the box. It's like the question about memory and time is being kicked outside of the scope of this prototype, and I'm accounting for it because I know that later I'll be able to write some efficient algorithm that compresses things.
Now, if you're doing a tech prototype and your question is, can I render 10,000 trees on a planet, you better not abstract that away by buying, like, an SLI NVIDIA thing, because you actually haven't gained understanding there. You've thrown content in the sense of CPU cycles at a problem where you actually needed code understanding.
So another key point is you don't want to commit to an abstraction, and sort of, like, you want to sort of keep your mental model very, very agile. So this sort of happens at two levels, because in some sense, because code is understanding, sort of the software we write is a representation of the problem in our heads, right? So you sort of have your mental model that needs to stay agile, as well as your software model that has to stay agile. So you want to not commit to an abstraction, because you want to be able to stay as agile as possible, able to reformulate, like, oh, there's another box here we didn't even realize. There's these connections here we didn't even think about.
Right, and so one of the ways this comes out in code is this whole toolkit versus framework thing. Toolkits don't force you to commit to an abstraction, whereas frameworks do. And so let's go through some adjectives that are associated with these. Like, toolkits are accommodant. If I have 3 toolkit functions, I can reorder them in 6 different ways and get 6 different results. That is agility. They're compositional in that way that I was just saying. Like, I can call the results of this one to feed into this one and feed into this one, and if I reorder them, everything changes. And that's great. They're immediate, like, you in the immediate versus retained sense. You've got your own data as the app. You don't know what your data structures are yet, so you just kind of have these hacked up data structures, and you just kind of push your data at the toolkit-y style APIs. It's like going to the deli. I can order a sandwich, hold the pickles, you get the extra tomato on the left-hand side. I can totally just order it up exactly as I want it. Where the framework is totally static, and it's controlling. Like, it calls you back when it feels like it. You, instead of, as opposed to you, like, telling it what to do, it's kind of, you know, you kind of have to ask it permission to do things. If you have 2 frameworks, like, good luck getting them to play together. It's retained. It wants to own all the data. Like, I have these data structures. That is committing to a mental model. If I have to, like, submit this giant piece of data and then ask it to change that data for me, I'm no longer agile from a data structure standpoint. It's like going to a French restaurant and getting a prefix dinner where, great, if you want exactly what's on the fixed menu, you're golden, because you can probably get a really nice meal that'll cost you a fortune, but it'll be awesome. If you want to actually change something, like, good luck, the like crazy French chef will kick you out of his restaurant. Like, it is not agile in that sense.
Then there's what we like to call the Tower of Tuning. which is
the Tower of Tuning.
Yes. Which is basically, you don't want to climb to the top of the tower because it's very expensive. So at the bottom of the Tower of Tuning is sort of like just recompiling your code, right? You can like, oh, you want to tweak some numbers, so you like, you know, go into your text editor, you change them, you recompile, you run. So there's a little bit of turnaround cost there, but it's generally going to be pretty fast, and it doesn't cost you anything for that feature.
Right, it's like I got float f equals 32 in my code somewhere, and like I just recompile. It takes a second and a half to recompile because it's a small app, it's a prototype. Like, that is agility.
If we like kick it up a notch, we can go to things like interactive editors where you can sort of do like level editing inside your program. So the program itself is giving you some kind of UI for like redesigning it on the fly, for like setting up the objects, like deleting characters and things like that. So that's like more upfront investment, and it's a more commitment to a particular mental model and a particular decomposition of the problem.
But you don't have to recompile.
And then there's data driving, which is, you know, you sort of have like these files and disk, and you sort of like load them up, and they have your tuning variables, and you can like change stuff, like reload your program. You don't have to recompile. You don't have to use an interactive editor. It's like, again, it's like more commitment. Now you have to sort of like know what your data structure is going to be to read it out of the disk. And then there's like hot loading is like a way of getting even more juice out of it. It's like this requires even more programming work. So there's like more investment here, but you're sort of getting more and more results. And then finally, there's the last level of the Tower of Tuning, which we don't think you ever want to go to in a prototype, which is scripting.
This is really different from using a scripting language as your main thing. If you want to write your prototypes in Python and use OpenGL, Python GL, or whatever, great, go for it. We're talking specifically about hooking a scripting language up to the side of a C program or something like that.
Right, because as soon as you do that, now you sort of committed to this huge abstraction. It's like, what are all the bindings in my C code and like my scripting language? I have all these variables and functions, and if I want to change my problem, my understanding of the problem, I have to now go back and change all of those interfaces.
So keep it synced.
It's like a huge investment. Like, I've built this huge tower now. I have to like climb all the way to the top. If I want to change something now, it's very, very expensive. So it's almost like it's simpler in a prototype to simply just like recompile it.
Yeah, I mean, I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, programmers love writing programs to make programs.
Yes,
right?
That's
like,
what I'm gonna
say. It's far more fun to like write an interpreter. Like,
that's exactly what I was gonna say. It's amazing. Yeah, it's like the it's cool to write scripting languages. Everybody loves to write scripting languages. Rah rah. It's just they almost always fail the cheap and light and agile metric.
The trap here is that you sort of invest like a couple weeks getting your scripting language up and running, and then you start attacking your actual problem. Then you realize that you're even solving the wrong problem, and it's like, all right, start over, right? Yep. So it's like you want to fail as quickly as possible. So doing the upfront investment in tech and tools is surely a waste of time.
So collaboration. Haim and I are both designer programmers in one person, and so when we do prototypes, we do it by ourselves generally. We have input from other people, and we do this feedback and stuff that we're going to talk about in the session after this. We talked about it a little bit before, but most of the feedback loop happens inside on the like you know microsecond level or however fast your brain works. It's like, should I do that? Yes. Oh no, that's a great idea. Okay, let's go. You know, it's like the conversation is very quick.
Really,
I'm so smart. That's awesome. Yes, you are. Yes.
It's really easy to have two bodies in one, right? It's like you don't have to talk to as many people.
And if you have artists as well in there, like it gets a little loud sometimes, but like it's totally awesome because you're like, I can do this art, okay, do that thing, yes, that'll work with my design, and that's totally awesome. It's really easy to go off the rails, though, is the problem.
Yeah, that's right. So you sort of like, you sometimes like, oh, this design's going to be so cool, you swear, like I'm going to like talk about this design, or I'm going to like get stuck in these technical details, and it's like easy to get stuck. So one way to mitigate that, and the sort of the more traditional model is you have like designers and you have programmers working together on prototypes or on products. And one of the cool things about this is that the programmer can kind of like bubble up constraints to the designer, and sort of like it could be like a negotiation basically. So it's like, well, you get three things. Like, this is your suitcase. It's this big. What's very important? So the programmer can sort of act to do sort of like a requirement solicitation from the designer.
Focus them. And this gets back to one of the top three reasons to prototype, which is the upside generation. you've got this top-down versus bottom-up thing going. If the designer like over-specifies when we're trying to work with a programmer, you've given up discovering this upside that almost always comes bottom-up by the programmer going, like, I'm implementing this thing, and I realize if I sort these in the opposite order, I get this whole thing for free or something like that. Right. It's not, that is not like this magic, that's not this like, oh, I hope that happens sometimes. That is core to writing a prototype. If that is not happening, you are sucking.
Yeah, I mean, the key is really sort of the programmer or the artist, whoever's down doing the detailed work, they can see things that you cannot see when you're up at the high level, right? So you can sort of see all of these opportunities you can sort of like just pick up and take advantage of when you're down in the details. On the other hand, sort of like having somebody sort of look over, sort of look at the big picture can help the programmer go from going off the rails too, right? If the programmer's like, oh, I'm going to make this awesome scripting language, and it's like, I'll get back to you in 3 weeks for the thing you asked for, and it's like, the designer can be like, what's happening? Like, where's my feature? Like, I want to try this thing out.
And so Chaim and I like think that the designer-programmer hybrid in a single person is a really, really effective thing, but that's a tight feedback loop thing versus the like collaborative the benefits here. So both are possible. We think that in the future there will be more designer-programmer hybrids, but this can totally work as well and has strengths as well. So so feedback. You've got this demo, or you've got this prototype you've made, and the whole point is to get feedback on it, to test your assumptions. And the way you do that, there's like this axis of PR versus science. And so, are we over in 3 minutes?
No, we're close.
Okay, we're over. So. Go.
So once you have your prototype built, you can use it in sort of multiple ways. You can use it as a PR device, right? You can be like, check out my cool thing, like, come look at this demo, like, you can do sort of the Peter Molyneux thing, right? And on the other end of the spectrum, you can sort of do this, like, scientific thing. We sort of do, like, a Kleenex testing, put somebody in a room, get behind the double pane glass, and, like, watch what they do, and don't tell them anything.
And we're not saying, like, normally at the GDC, if you put up a slide that says science on one side and PR on the other, you're like, science is the correct answer. That's actually not what we're saying. PR is incredibly valuable here. So we've got these two words we're going to actually use instead of PR and science, which is testing and demoing. And they're both very important to actually having a successful prototype. So I'm going to talk about demoing really quick, and Hans is going to talk about testing, and then we're almost done. So for demoing, this persuasion aspect, this subversion disruptive aspect is vitally important. Like, that should be happening. Your ideas should be convincing people, or your ideas are wrong. And you've got the prototype there to tell. So you're demoing it constantly. You're getting feedback from people. If you show somebody something to somebody, they will have lots of good ideas for you. And that is great. It's like, there's the like, I'm so great, I should make my own ideas, like, leave me alone. But no, getting the more idea churn in there is actually way better. And the secret additional thing there is, if you demo something for somebody, and they have an idea, and then you integrate that idea in and then show it to them the next day, they are yours forever. Like, you have gotten a massive amount of buy-in because it's like, oh, cool, that was my idea, and like, hey, Bob, come over here and check out this cool idea that that Chris put in my demo or whatever. That is huge for convincing people of stuff.
And there's also a certain amount of science in demoing, right? It's like, you can take somebody, put them in front of your machine, and like watch their face. Like, do they smile? Or do they look confused? They look like they get it, and like, you can use that as a data
point. Right. So it's not just a PR. The amount you talk and how you do that dictates where you are along that axis. But it is a continuum. So here's another slightly non-intuitive thing about demoing. This is how I used to be. And so basically what this is you're trying to get somewhere. You don't actually know where that point is yet, but you can kind of take derivatives along the way. And I used to go like, okay, I've got this idea, or somebody gave me a challenge of a question to answer, like say it's a good prototype, and I would go away for a while and then come back with my beautiful jewel that I would then show people. And then we would say like, okay, that wasn't quite right. So then I'll go away for a while and come back later. That's actually bad. What you want to do,
and of course, also like all along the way, you're sort of going in one direction, and it's like not actually like a linear thing. It's like, I want to go here. All right, back up.
You're exploring, this might have gone over this way. But the key thing here is that you're like going away. You're not getting feedback on a really granular basis. And so there's a couple things here. One important one is you actually spent way more time. I'm about to blast you in the eye if you don't stand back. I've blinded my co-speaker. You spent way more than just the linear. There's a linear distance. It's a lot faster. So what you want to do is actually get feedback on a way more granular basis. So if you're actually showing something to somebody every day, you can get course corrections and new ideas and cool stuff and stay way more on the rails. Like, people don't wait. Like, here's the amazing non-intuitive thing about this that took me a while to learn. I thought this one had more autonomy. I was like, leave me alone. I'm going to go do my cool thing. This one actually gives you more autonomy. How is that possible? Because by showing people, how is that possible? By showing people stuff every day, please fill out your eval forms as you leave because we're late. And you can turn your cell phone back on. By showing people stuff every day, they have clear understanding of where you are. And if you're producing cool stuff to show them every day, you're like the goose who's laying the golden eggs. They just totally leave you alone.
Right. So the other kind of thing we can do is test, right? So this is ultimately about like validating your hypothesis. Like, did this work? Did this not work? And of course, if you're sort of moving more on the test axis, you want to be quiet and you just want to like gather observations. You don't want to like gather like, oh, I think we should do this, I think we should do that. You want to be like, the data you want to get back is to be like, the player did this and the player did that and the player did that and they didn't like that. Finally, once you're done, you've gotten your data, you want to like keep track of what you've done, what you've learned, because it's actually very easy in a large project when you have lots of people coming on and they haven't seen all the prototypes, they haven't actually played them, because games are actually kind of hard to play, there's a high overhead. You want to make sure you sort of keep track of why you did things and how you ended up where you did.
Yeah, you people come back to you a week later, like, I got this great idea, and you're like, we just prototyped that last week, like, come on. Like, so you need a place to like send those people.
Yeah, and thank you very much.
That is our talk. Thanks. Yeah.